This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
Hello everyone, welcome to the History of Persia. I'm Trevor Cully, and this is episode 150, The Time Lord. This has certainly taken longer than I expected, but then again, I wasn't really prepared for how much has happened in the last month and a half. My wife is now a space doctor, I met my baby nephew for the first time, and my city, for the moment, was ravaged by tornadoes. Then I had a wedding to go to, and my job went haywire. It's still going, TBH, but the long and short of it is, it's been a long summer, and when I wrote this paragraph, it wasn't even technically summer yet. Oh, and the news. The motherfucking news. I'll address that either in a different episode or on America's Secret Wars. We'll see how things develop. Okay, let's talk timey-wimey stuff so that I can get on to some straightforward narrative episodes again. At the time of recording, the first episode of Antiochus II is already written and ready to go, so let's hope for smooth sailing for at least a little while. To recap, in the last three episodes, I introduced the concepts of Orphism, the mythology of the bard cleric Orpheus, the basic beliefs of the Orphic religion, and their strange, complex ideas of how the universe and humanity came to be. All the while, I've been promising this all somehow ties back to Iran, Zoroastrianism, and the Hellenistic Age. Today's the day. We are starting with everyone's favorite topic, a discussion of our sources, because I am, admittedly, really stretching things to cover this topic here, but I think it is important to include at this stage of the narrative, and the ancient authors involved are at least interesting in their own right. This entire series has been predicated on a single paragraph from the early 6th century CE. So over 700 years after our current narrative place. Specifically, it comes from Damascius's Difficulties and Solutions of the First Principle, a very late Neoplatonic philosophical text about the creation of the universe. Damascius of Athens himself was situated at a very unique point in history, Almost 200 years after Christianity was first accepted as the state religion of the Roman Empire, and after a series of imperial crackdowns on traditional polytheistic beliefs. But it was before those beliefs vanished entirely. In fact, Damascius's story is sort of the story of how that happened. He was the last scholark to lead Plato's Academy in Athens before the Emperor Justinian ordered its closure, and Damascius fled to Persia. That, of course, is a story for another time, in like 7 or 8 years probably, but it provides context. Damascius's treatise on the first principles was written partially to provide as much pagan opposition to Christian dogma as possible. That led him to analyze basically as many different approaches to the story of creation as he could get his hands on, and one of the greater shames of history is that none of his work after fleeing Athens has survived, because I suspect he would have had a lot to say about the religious movements he encountered in the East. Instead, we just have this one short paragraph that provides a very broad description of Iranian religion. But it does cite its sources, or rather, source, the now-lost philosopher Eudemus of Rhodes, a student of Aristotle who flourished in the latter half of the 4th century BCE, right at the start of the Hellenistic era. Some of the more noteworthy fragments have allowed scholars to place a few of his works on mathematics and astronomy together, but Eudemus's History of Theology remains effectively lost to the sands of time. However, since he is cited by Damascius as a source for both Orphism and Zoroastrianism, and he wrote in the time period we are currently discussing, I am latching on to what I can get here. If Eudemus is the citation, then we can reasonably intuit that the beliefs being discussed were contemporary with the Rhodian philosopher, if not slightly older. So without further ado, the so-called paragraph from Damascius. As for the Magi and the entire Iranian people, as Eudemus writes about this, some of them call the intelligible and universe space, using the Greek word topos, and others call it time, the Greek word chronos, from which are differentiated either a good deity or a bad demon, or light and darkness before these, as some say. And they then themselves posit the twofold differentiated rank of the superiors after the undifferentiated nature, one leader of which is Horomazda, and the other of which is Aremanios. I will be entirely honest, I'm not sure what exactly Eudemus and or Damascius meant by topos as the first principle in Iranian belief. That's not really a concept I've encountered personified in the same way as time before. But I guess you could read it as Zoroastrian creation stories lacking the absolute non-existence of some Greek myths. Even at its most arcane, Zoroastrianism still presents creation as happening in the cosmos, as opposed to the Greeks' description of chaos and aether coming into existence from absolute nothingness. Thwasha, the Zoroastrian equivalent of topos, is usually referenced alongside Zervan, but so are most of the other more abstract Yazadas that represent different elements of the cosmos, like Vayu and Vata, wind and air, which are somewhat comparable to the Greek ideas of chaos and aether. Time, the Greek chronos, is another matter entirely. As Eudemus and Damascius explain it, time is a first principle, the first concept to exist in the universe. And from time came good and evil, light and dark, the polar opposite divinities Damascius called Horamasta, and Aremanios, and which I usually call Ahura Mazda and Angra Mainyu. This is ever so slightly different from the way I usually present things, or the way it usually appears in the Avesta, or the way it is usually framed by modern Zoroastrians. In all of those cases, either Ahura Mazda is the first principle of the universe, and all things, including evil, emanate from accepting or rejecting him, or Ahura Mazda and Angra Mainyu both existed simultaneously, and their endless conflict gave rise to the dualistic universe as we know it. Eudemus provides our earliest hint at an alternative view of these ideas, wherein time existed first, and Ahura Mazda and Angra Mainyu differentiated themselves from the great, winding neutrality of time itself, or to use the Avestan name, Zervon. We have encountered Zervon in passing a few times before, usually as just one of the many Yazadas listed in scripture. The most notable appearance was probably in my episode on the Vendidad, where Zervon is described as the creator of the Chinvat Bridge, where dead souls are judged. The bridge from life to death is literally described as a passage of time, with a capital T. Aside from that, though, Zervon doesn't really appear to be very important beyond providing the concept of time to the universe. He's not usually presented up there with Ahura Mazda, Mithra, Anahita, and the other big Yazadas. Until we get to Eudemus. Then all of a sudden, Zervon is the first principle of the universe. Under normal circumstances, this is the sort of thing we would immediately write off as a Greek misconception, or projecting more familiar beliefs like those of Orphism onto their Iranian neighbors. This is not a normal circumstance, though. Fast forward a few centuries from Eudemus to the 3rd century CE. You're now in the reign of the Sassanid dynasty of Persia. Greek rule has long been swept away, and the Zoroastrian religion is more organized and tied to the government than ever before. The Mobadan Mobed, priest of priests, is second in influence only to the King of Kings, and some of those high priests have left inscriptions to rival those of the kings they ruled alongside. These inscriptions express a worldview that sounds a lot like what Eudemus proposed Iranians believed centuries earlier. So now we have Zervon as a first principle, circa 300 BC and 300 CE, but minimal evidence to support that view in the Avesta, nor any source from the intervening 600 years. Nor, for that matter, most post-Sassanid sources. This Zoroastrian sect, called Zervanism, appears to have emerged at the tail end of the Achaemenid period, but struggled to find purchase until a new dynasty of Persian kings emerged. One possibility that I simultaneously think is probably close to the truth, and have no evidence for, is that Zervanism largely developed in Persis, which would explain its ties to the Sassanids and seeming absence from the wider Iranian discourse in the interim period. Regardless of its exact history, Zervanite beliefs are rooted in some fairly obscure Avestan theology, at least to modern readers. It's entirely possible that a better explanation would have been found in the innumerable lost Avestan hymns, but we work with what we've got. In the Avesta, Zervon is given two epithets. He is both Zervon Akarana and Zervon Dario Kivadata, translated literally as infinite time and time of the long dominion. Despite what Gore Vidal's novel Creation may lead you to believe, The time of the Long Dominion is actually the present. Or more accurately, the human way of perceiving time as a linear sequence of events in the universe created by Ahura Mazda. Infinite time is the more sci-fi counterpart, the big ball of timey-wimey stuff for you Doctor Who fans. Zervon Akarana is a boundless, non-linear experience of time outside the mortal universe. Zervon Akarana is the version posited as a first principle, and in a very Orphic way, it sort of implies that Akarana is the original power of creation, like Kronos in the beginning of the Orphic Rhapsodies, and Dareyog Kvadata is a reformed version in Ahura Mazda's new universe. It's not quite that one-to-one. No version of Zoroastrianism has all of the baton-passing universe recreation of the Orphics, but the Long Dominion is Zervon of our universe, and Akarana is Zervon as a first principle of creation. Many secular scholars of Zoroastrianism, such as Mary Boyce, have suggested that Zervonism was actually fairly widespread in the former Achaemenid West, in Iranian holdout regions like Cappadocia and Armenia, as well as Mesopotamia and Persis. They point to the Greek and Roman sources that seem to cling strongly to the core Zervonite principle. Ahura Mazda and Angra Mainyu are equal and opposite twins created simultaneously. As I've said, this conclusion isn't impossible to reach without including Zervon in the equation. If anything, I think it's actually the most consistent view with the Gothas, aside from Angra Mainyu apparently not being a name that early in the theology. However, Zervonism, following a very similar line of thought to various Greek and Babylonian mythographers over the centuries, appears to spring from the fact that it is difficult to reconcile Ahura Mazda as purely good and aligned with Asha, as well as the sole creator of everything, which would have to include Angra Mainyu, Druj, and evil in general. As I've said in the past, one of the things about Zoroastrianism I find particularly endearing is that purely Mazdian theology answers this question with free will. Ahura Mazda is purely good, and part of that is allowing his creations to have free will, including the freedom to reject goodness. Zervonism found a different explanation. Angra Mainyu, later called Ahriman, was an accidental byproduct of Ahura Mazda's creation, and their opposition began when Zervon granted supremacy of the universe to Ahura Mazda. In this way, both good and evil appear as equal forces at the moment of creation, with good simply ranking above evil, and evil in constant conflict over that fact. I want to spend the rest of this episode talking about the outside influences, including Greek Orphism, that may have influenced these conclusions. But first, I want to suggest a theory for why, when, and where Zervonism first emerged and later became popular. Free will and human error as fundamental parts of Asha, Ahura Mazda's divinely ordained perfect order for the universe, are great. I'd personally argue that they are still a moral good today, whether you're Zoroastrian or not. However, they are not exactly compatible with autocracy and the divine right of kings. If evil is just as fundamental to the universe as good, and the steady march of time rather than simple goodness is the ultimate driver of the universe, then free will is suddenly a lot less important, if it even exists at all. In fact, this exact view is espoused by the Dadastan Menag Ikrad, a medieval Zoroastrian text, and one of the latest to espouse a Zervanite approach to theology. In that text, the author wrote that Ahura Mazda allotted happiness to humanity, but if we do not receive it, it is because of the intercession of the planets. This is a reference to astrology, specifically the Babylonian-influenced astrology used in much of ancient West Asia, where the planets disrupt life on Earth by their movements through the skies. In Zoroastrianism specifically, the unfixed movements of the planets compared to their static star counterparts led astrologers to interpret the planets as a largely evil influence on astrological predictions. In some medieval translations of the Menag Ikrad, Zervan was translated as fate rather than simply time. And since the movement of the planets are predictable, this declaration suggests that some Zervanites believed in a form of predestination rather than free will. So why, when, and where? In reverse order, the Persian Empire under the Achaemenid and Sassanid dynasties. And because diminishing the role of free will in theology and the fallibility of kings and priests provided excellent support for the sort of divine right monarchy that ruled those empires. It excused their failings and solidified their importance as divinely ordained not only because of the inherent goodness of Ahura Mazda, but a predetermined path set out by an even higher power. If we accept 20th century authors like Mary Boyce and Robert Zahner, then I think we can get even more specific. Those scholars suggest that this predestination was tied to Babylonian theology, which would conveniently tie the rise of Zervan to the Babylonian-influenced religious changes under Darius II and Artaxerxes II, which would be right around the proper time for it to reach the Greeks, and by extension Eudemus, in the 4th century. Now, or I guess in about 2 minutes, we will shift to Orphic influences after the break. Believe it or not, language learning doesn't have to be difficult. You can learn naturally and speak confidently. Rosetta Stone helps you absorb a language the same way you learned your first one, through real-world context and conversation, not memorization. Practical skills you can use right away. The no memorization thing is a big plus to me. I've never been the type of person to pick up language through flipping over flashcards. Rosetta Stone is the trusted language expert with 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages offered as the go-to language learning solution. There's no English translations. You just learn to speak, listen, and think in the language you're trying to learn. It's a more intuitive learning process, starting with words, building to phrases, and progressing to sentences. Plus, if you're like me and you're trying to learn a language that uses sounds you're not used to, the built-in True Accent speech recognition feature provides real-time feedback to help you improve those pronunciations. You can also learn anytime and anywhere with a mobile app or on your desktop. And of course, as always, it is an incredible value. You can learn for life with a lifetime membership that gives you access to all 25 languages, so you can learn as many as you want, whenever you want. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. History of Persia listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. Now we get to the whole reason for this big, long series of episodes in the first place. Part of that should already be clear if you remember the big themes of this episode and the last one. Zervanism first appeared in the historical record right around the time that Kronos started appearing in the forefront of Orphic beliefs about the universe. The Greeks are all over Iran and West Asia. The Greeks start thinking about the god of time as the creator of the universe in a cosmology where later deities can take over and become the new de facto creator god. The Iranians start talking about a theology where the time god is the creator of the universe, and a created deity then takes over as the new de facto creator god. It's not a huge leap in logic to think those two developments might be connected. We even know that this was a period of a lot of religious cross-pollination. The early Hellenistic Age would have been the time when the Armenians absorbed a lot of Zoroastrian beliefs and deities into their own practices, and Zoroastrian influences are obvious in a lot of Second Temple Jewish texts as well, as are Greek philosophical influences. As I've said before, Zoroastrian developments are a lot harder to trace in this period. But by the time we get another burst of information in the 3rd century CE, it's clear that they had absorbed plenty of external influence too. That's just what happens when you have so many overlapping and moving communities for a long enough period of time. Originally, this section was going to be quite short. I was basically going to reiterate the evidence and muse about the causes and effects of those influences just a bit. Basically, this episode was supposed to be a brief introduction to Zervanism to let you all know that this concept is cooking in the background of Iranian belief, and to allow me to reference it without much explanation before we get to the big Zervanite moment in the Sassanid period. Then, I read the Derveni Papyrus, and I had to reassess my entire hypothesis. You would think I ran out of big, dramatic, pre-Hellenistic developments in Greco-Persian relations a long time ago. I certainly wouldn't have expected something as big as one of the most famous documents in European archaeology to be completely glossed over in all of the sources I've encountered for the last decade if it were relevant. And yet, here we are. 9 years and 9 months, almost to the day since I first started researching ancient Zoroastrianism, and I am just now discovering the idea of esoteric Greek magi. After a lot of searching, I think I know why, though. There's just not much written about this for anybody else in Iranology to encounter it either. So I'm relying heavily on a paper called The Magi in the Derveni Papyrus by James R. Russell. And, by the simple luck of good timing and taking too long to deliver this episode, a dissertation by Garrett Hansen at the University of Arizona, which cannot have been online for more than a few weeks at the time this episode releases. It is established that the Greeks had a fascination with the Magi both before and after the Hellenistic period, and they frequently associated them with exceptional philosophical and mythical accomplishments, like attributing all of Babylonian science to Zoroaster, or the philosopher Empedocles describing a magus who could descend into Hades and retrieve a dead soul in exchange for magical powers. And that view of things is pretty common in Greek literature. From the Greek perspective, Zoroastrian, and generally Iranian rites and beliefs were strange, foreign, and very much alien from their common strains of religion. And we have discussed all of that before. Try as they might to interpret comparisons between the gods of the Persians and Medes with their own, the classical Greeks just struggled to grasp Zoroastrianism. So instead, some writers let their fantasies run wild, and Magos, the most common title of Iranian priests, became synonymous with magic, an influence that persists across many languages to this day in the word magic itself. Often in Hellenistic literature, Magos would be better translated as wizard than cleric. But then we get this passage from the Derveni Papyrus describing Orphic rites. The beginning and ending sentences are cut off by damage to the document, but here we go. Yada yada yada, broken, broken, broken. Prayers and offerings appease the souls, whereas the incantation of the Magoi is powerful enough to change the daimones who hinder the souls. The daimones hinder because they are hostile to the souls. That is why the Magoi perform the sacrifice, as if paying compensation. And over the sacrifices they pour water and milk, from which they make also their libations. They make offerings of innumerable and many navelled cakes, because the souls are also innumerable. Initiates make preliminary sacrifices to the Eumenides in the same manner as the Magoi, because the Eumenides are souls, on whose account whoever intends to sacrifice to the gods must first make an offering of poultry to broken, broken, broken. Here we have a description of an Orphic ritual in pre-Alexandrian Macedonia, presided over by initiates who are described as doing the same thing as magi, driving away daimones. You can probably guess that daimon is the root word of the modern English word demon, which is true. But in ancient Greek, it meant something more like micro-deity, or spirit, a vague category of supernatural beings that influenced daily life. These could be good or bad, and in this case, we are obviously talking about bad daimones, kakodaimones in Greek. These hinder the souls of humanity. But even with that context, the use here with magi is interesting. Specifically, the end of the paragraph reveals that these daimones in particular are the Eumenides, also called the Erinyes or the Furies, underworld goddesses that punish the souls in the afterlife. There are a lot of similar testing spirits in world mythology, but one obvious comparison rises above the rest. It's even etymologically related. Daivas. Greek kakodaimones and Zoroastrian lesser daivas are extremely similar. It goes further, too. This ritual involves libations of water and milk, which sounds plausibly similar to some Hauma rituals described in the Avesta. The many navelled cakes described in Derveni Papyrus also bear some resemblance to baked goods common in later Zoroastrian funeral services that might just not have been documented in as much detail this far back in time. James R. Russell even makes a connection between the offering of poultry and Zoroastrian beliefs which historically associated the rooster and its sunrise crowing with the Yazada Srausha, the patron of human conscience who hears our prayers. The prayers in this case being for the end of darkness. Of course, in that context, even in very ancient times, Zoroastrians would not have sacrificed a bird that was sacred to one of the Yazadas, but it's not unreasonable to think that something was lost in translation here. Or alternatively, it refers to some other kind of bird sacrifice common in Persian territory at the time. Russell specifically suggests that this could all be related to Greeks witnessing a formal Satum ceremony, a Zoroastrian prayer for honoring the dead and their fravashis. I don't know if I'd be quite as willing to pin this one ancient paragraph on a specific ceremony, but something of that nature would make sense in context. Regardless of what ceremony or ceremonies these Macedonian Orphics were aware of, the Derveni Papyrus makes one thing clear. The initiates saw enough similarity between their own beliefs about death and those of their neighbors to the east to deliberately copy Iranian rituals into their own rites. And of course, that opens a further question for my inquiries here. Which came first, the sacrificial chicken or the cosmic egg? Unlike my original expectations of Orphism directly influencing Zervanite beliefs, this appears to have been a very two-way street. It's just hard to say which story and belief set originated on which side. Almost all of our sources for Zervanism come from much later, but the connection is undeniable at this early point in history. The simple fact of the matter is that we just can't know how exactly this religious exchange played out, or in what order. What we can do is talk about those points of overlap. Scholars love to point out the similarities between Greek mythology and other myths from West Asia, and there are almost certainly influences there, especially in the structure of the theogony. But just because a group like the Hittites wrote down their stories first doesn't mean that we should assume that one group borrowed from another. Broad strokes of the theogony and mythical motifs like wars of succession between the gods are common across many cultures, both related and not. So we'll bypass that issue for now. One idea that is a bit more specific is the cosmic egg. In the last episode, I discussed how the Orphic creation god Phanes emerged from an egg created in the primordial matter by Kronos, the god of time. A version of this appears in Zoroastrian literature as well, specifically the Bundahishan, which is not a Zervanite text, but was written after the period of Zervanite dominance. And it says, "First he, Ormazd, created the sky, bright, visible, distant, in the form of an egg, made of shining iron, its essence steel, male, joined at the top to the endless light." That is at least similar enough to be of note, especially to some Orphic ideas of Nyx the Night being the primordial essence. But I should note that Garrett Hansen dismisses this potential connection in his thesis, pointing to the clearly Mazdaite focus of the Bundahishan. But Hansen is an Orphic scholar, not focused on Zoroastrianism, and I think his narrow focus on the Bundahishan in his review is just as misguided. Given that it's also from the 8th or 9th century CE, the Bundahishan should be seen as a product of Zoroastrianism after Zervanism had a chance to influence more conventional theology. So while Zervan might not be the principal force in the universe to that text, Zervanite ideas, or even ideas that influenced both Orthodox practice and Zervanism at an earlier point, should be expected. Significantly earlier, we might have either a point of influence on both the Zoroastrians and the Orphics, something from broader Indo-Iranian culture that filtered in, or the concept that influenced ancient Zoroastrians before reaching Greece. The Indic Chandogya Upanishad, which includes the passage, "In the beginning this world was non-being, then it was being, then it sprang up, then an egg developed, then it lay for the duration of a year, then it broke. The two halves of the egg were silver and gold. The silver one, this was the earth, the golden one, the sky." That is from around 700 BCE, and it certainly sounds a lot like the cosmic egg in Orphism and the Bundahishan. Early Indic sources provide another point of influence in the even older Atharvaveda, dated to around 1000 BCE, in which there is no cosmic egg, but there is a cosmic embryo. And time is credited as the creation god. Eudemus, as in our source for the so-called Eudemian Theogony, is once again cited by Damascius to describe another similar tale from Sidon in Phoenicia. Once again, we have time as the first deity, followed by several generations of primordial gods, and then a cosmic egg. Hansen dismisses this connection as well, which again, I think is misguided for many of the same reasons he uses as evidence in his own argument. Damascius only offers a summary, and slight differences like inserting more primordial generations before or after the egg doesn't really point to a lack of connection, just a different understanding of the cosmos. In general, Hansen is very focused on drawing a connection between the Hittite Kumbari cycle and Greek religion, which is accurate. Evidence for significant cultural exchange between the Mycenaean Greeks and the Hittites has been accumulating for decades. If anything, the strong parallels in both Hittite and Vedic texts might point to some other, as yet undocumented influence, an Indo-European origin, or just a case of convergent cultural evolution during the Bronze Age, which eventually all mixed together in the Classical period. And that brings me back to the Magi, because Hansen too came to roughly the same conclusion as Russell. The author of the Derveni Papyrus was familiar with some Zoroastrian theology and ritual to a degree rarely seen in pre-Hellenistic Greek writing. The biggest difference is that Hansen suggests the Lan ceremony referenced in the Persepolis fortification tablets as a point of origin instead of the Satum prayer. That seems both more and less likely depending on the angle you approach the question from. On one hand, the Lan has the benefit of contemporary documentation, but on the other, it also seems to be more generic than the specific ritual described by the Derveni author. Either way, the basic concept is the same. Of course, we're still talking about two strains of religious thought at a time in history when our total evidence for both of them could fit inside a thick pamphlet. There is evidence for lots of potential outside influence on both Orphism and Zervanism, all over West and South Asia. And yet, right at the moment when Zervanism first enters the historical record, we have two crucial pieces of evidence. This is the same point in time that Kronos became a core deity in Orphic belief, and the Derveni Papyrus directly states that Orphic initiates imitated the rituals of the Iranian Magi. Trying to draw straight lines in religious history is a fool's errand. There's always a milieu of ideas influencing one another. And there are plenty of other better documented examples of how Greek and Iranian thought connected. All of that said, if the timeline fits, wear it. Regardless of whether it was the Hellenes or the Iranians who had the idea of time as a primary force first, they were sharing ideas back and forth in the Hellenistic Age. And that will eventually manifest into highly influential religious movements for both cultures. And scene. All right, everybody, that's the Orphic Zervanite series in the bag. Next time, God's willing, without too much delay, we are back to the narrative and its full steam ahead through Antiochus II, aka Antiochus the god. Until then, if you want more information about this podcast, you can go to hopfulmedia.com. That's where you'll find things like my bibliography, episode imagery, and additional resources. If you want to hear more of my voice, you can listen to America Secret Wars, where I tell my friends and guests the story of forgotten and overlooked conflicts in American history. And if you want to support my projects, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merch, or subscribe to get access to ad-free listening and bonus content. If you don't want to spend money on me, that's absolutely fine. The best ways to support a project like this are to share on social media or leave reviews on your podcast app of choice. So review on Apple, rate on Spotify, and you can find me on Blue Sky at History of Persia and on Instagram at History of Persia Podcast. Until next time, thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.